Over 70 million albums sold. Midnight. The first ever female pop star.
I want your midnights.
Not a lesbian. Oh, at all.
Feels like a perfect night for breakfast at midnight.
Taylor Swift.
Hello everyone and welcome to an extra special edition of Snapped. We hope you haven't missed us too much. As usual, we are your hosts. I'm Paul.
And I'm Pete.
And we are turning back the clocks to midnight in order to determine if Taylor truly snapped again.
I'm so excited to delve into this album. It's such a cultural moment for everyone when Taylor decides to release a new album. So actually this is Taylor's 10th studio album, not counting Fearless and Red, Taylor's version, and was released today, the day of recording, October 21st, 2022. Unfortunately, the album did leak 2 days ago, early on the 19th of October, but us dedicated Swifties waited until this morning. We're going to talk about our little bit more personal, raw opinions after only a few listens. The Queen of Mayhem did decide to announce that she had 7 more tracks this morning at 8 a.m., when I had a call in work at 9 a.m., so thank you.
She doesn't care about us workers.
We're hoping to revisit this album a little bit further down the line on a future episode of Snapped and absolutely scalp our past selves for their wrong and scandalous opinions.
Yes, please, pitchforks away, because this is a very first draft in our opinions. Probably will really change after multiple listens and delving into the tracks. So don't hate us if we don't love your favorite track.
So, Paul, take us back to the beginning. How did Midnight start?
Okay, so we're jumping back only about 2 months when Taylor was nominated for 5 VMAs in 2022 for the All Too Well 10-minute version, Taylor's version, short film. It's like a tongue twister. Back in August 28th, 2022, she actually won 3 of these awards, and in her acceptance speech for Video of the Year Award, she announced a brand new studio album scheduled for release on October 21st, 2022. Gag. The girls were gagged.
We were gagged.
I thought we were going to get like 1989 Taylor's version. I'm still waiting.
Literally any time of year, Paul has grabbed me and gone, it's going to be this week.
And it's never ever this week. She literally will record a full new album instead of recording it. But we thought we were going to get another Taylor's version announcement maybe. But shortly after, Taylor's website was updated with a clock counting down to midnight and the phrase, meet me at midnight. At midnight, Taylor then posted across her social media accounts that her 10th studio album is called Midnights, which she described as the stories of 13 sleepless nights scattered throughout her life. Any Swiftie will know that 13 is a really important number to Taylor, going all the way back to the Fearless World Tour, where she painted the lucky number 13 on the back of her hand each night she performed.
And lucky we were. The key promotional strategy for this album was a 70s-inspired faux TV show called Midnight's Mayhem with Me, where Taylor used a bingo ball cage to randomly, in inverted commas, reveal the track list for the album on TikTok. This began on September 21st, and it appeared that we were getting 3 tracks a week, all the way up to the week prior to the album release. Unfortunately, again, the track list leaked online, thanks gays, and forced Taylor to upload the last 5 songs all in one night on October 7th, 2022. Now, Paul, do you think the balls were randomly released, or do you think she was keeping specific ones to keep to the end? Like, I think we all thought track 5 was going to be last.
Yeah, I was shook when she released the ball for track 5, kind of in the middle. And then when she did Karma, again, a song people really had a lot of speculation about, I was surprised that wasn't last. But then when she spun the ball, it's even funny by the end, you can see like how tedious it is to try and get a ball out because there's only like 3 balls left in it. And then the last one rolls out. She's like, it's track number 4, Snow on the Beach. I'm like, cool. And then she's like, featuring Lana Del Rey. Gag.
As well as the fact that in the leak of the track list, the names were right, but there was no features.
Right, exactly. Like, no one had actually leaked the fact that Lana was on this song. I mean, we'll get there. I don't think it really probably could have leaked, given that she's not really involved.
Is she on the song?
True. But yeah, I kind of feel as though they left that song until the end intentionally. But I wonder, did she, like, roll it, a number came out, if number 4 came out, she popped it back in, but the rest were random? I would believe that to be true.
As with anything, especially on TikTok, there were 1 million speculations for every movement, word, intonation, glance that she made in every single video. I remember the first one must have been studied in an English class somewhere, because everyone had 1 million opinions about how many times she said fate, how many times she looked at the camera, when she smiled, when she held the telephone upside down. But I think there might be some credence to that one. What do you think about that? Because two tracks have that.
Yeah, I think there is some truth in that. You know, she holds a telephone to announce sort of like a speaker of what the song title is. And she holds it upside down for Antihero, track three, which actually is sort of the quasi first single, you know, with the music video and all of that production behind it. And then she also does it for a song called Vigilante Shit, which I suspect will then be the second single with the music video and concept behind it. So I think the Swifties have maybe pinpointed her correctly on that one.
Yeah, I even saw some speculation that because it was upside down, it was a feature. And then that because it was upside down and Harry Styles' album was in a room upside down, that he was featured on those songs. And I don't know why, but it's kind of camp to see how strongly they believe that what they're saying is true. And a lot of the girls did speculate that it was going to be a double album because of repeated words or the promotion coming up to today, and they were kind of right, kind of wrong, but we'll get into that later. So as always on Snapped, we do love an album cover, and we're actually staring right now at Paul's office, which is covered in iconic album covers, many of which were covered on season one. So what do you think of the album cover for Midnights?
I think it's really cool. I really like it. At first though, I was a bit unsure for multiple different reasons. I feel like the font is the one that they use at the Apple announcement events. It's very plain. And it's not really as high concept as I thought it was going to be. And also, before the track list was announced, they do have track 1 to track 13 listed out on the front of the cover, which I wasn't too sure about visually. But I actually think it's really cool. It takes a lot of inspiration from old-fashioned LP jackets whose songs were listed on the front cover. So again, throwing back to that 70s, 80s sort of sound that we're getting on this album as well. And the photograph of Taylor shows her in blue eyeshadow, black eyeliner, and a signature red lip. Now, I feel like the blues and the blacks kind of encapsulates the theming of the album that we're getting as well. So I really like when we get a bit of a tease about what the album might be like from that. And she's holding a glimmering lighter held near her face. And we also saw on TikTok that Joe Alwyn, Taylor's long-term boyfriend, the muse of Reputation and King of the Pod, as well as the co-writer of Sweet Nothing on this album, actually has his own letter collection. He had shown off in an interview with GQ magazine, with the cover likely a tease that he ignites her fire as well.
Yes, so now we're going to deep dive into the track list in order, giving you our thoughts on the tracks, but you have to wait until the end for our final thoughts on the album. We'll also be sharing some of our listeners' initial thoughts on the album too. Thank you so much to everyone who submitted their favorites over on Instagram at SnapPod, wink. Feel free to jump back and forth between this episode and the album to listen along with us.
Oh, it looks like it's midnight, so it's time to get started.
Let's start with track 1, Lavender Haze. Okay, so let's just say it. What an incredible opener. Like, whoa.
Yeah, I was shook when it played, because obviously we didn't have any idea really beforehand of what the sound of this album was going to be. She didn't release any singles beforehand. This was the first experience of the new sound of Taylor. And it's a really synth pop inspired song with the use of her higher register throughout, which really contrasts against Folklore and Evermore, which are a lot more piano and guitar based ballads throughout the most of the album.
Yeah, I'm not sure if other people thought so, but I kind of went in expecting a more 70s sound based on the visuals. But like when we hit play this morning, I was like, thank you God, because we had heard a lot of like mixed reviews from the people who did listen to the leaks of like, oh, it was her worst, oh, it was her best, album of the year, flop of the year.
Midnights, okay, girls.
But I was so happy because this was one of the ones that we were really looking forward to just based off the name and her explaining what it was about.
Yeah, she sort of reveals that she was inspired by the phrase Lavender Haze when she heard it in the TV show Mad Men. So she says she looked up the phrase because she thought it sounded cool. And it turns out it's a really common phrase used in the 50s where they would describe being in love. And, you know, she's still so in love with Joel whenever since she met in the Reputation era.
And as we know, I love Reputation. And this just has such a flavor of Reputation, where it's such a concept of everyone critiquing her, everyone having something to say about her, and her going home to Joe, and Joe doesn't give a fuck. Like, he doesn't care what's in the news. He doesn't care that they're allegating that he's cheating. Oh, they're allegating that they're getting married. Like, they just go home. She just wants to sit in this happiness that she has so naturally with him that she hasn't had with any of her previous relationships.
I also really love that the first lyric of the album is "Meet Me at Midnight." I think she starts her albums really strong recently. Folklore in particular, with "I'm Doing Good, I'm On Some New Shit," is impactful. And I do think putting the concept of the album in the first line makes a lot of sense. Taylor sometimes has a lot of track listing issues in terms of where she puts the songs in the sequence, but this is a really strong opener for me, because it sort of is using the themes that we've heard throughout the start of the era, from her saying "Meet Me at Midnight" at the VMAs all the way to the "Midnight Mayhem with Me," where she keeps saying it. I just think it's sonically really strong.
Yeah, her voice is incredible in this, and just really, I don't know, the production feels like lilac. I don't know, like the purpley kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but it really just put a smile on our face this morning that it was going the way we wanted to go at that point.
True. And I just really want to shout out the lyric, "All they keep asking me is if I'm going to be your bride. The only kind of girl they see is a one night or a wife." And I'm just like, she came for men in this one. And the media and them constantly asking, is she married to Joe Alwyn? Are they going to get engaged? She's so correct that people just get categorized into whether they're a one night stand slut or their wife, their possession, their last name. And I just love that Taylor's like, I'm just me in this relationship, and she's 50-50 with Joe. I really love it.
Don't say me.
No, we're not going to summon any me exclamation marks in this album. And now we're going to slide right over to track number 2, Maroon. The red tees in this song really specifically is so nostalgic to me.
Wait, do you think this song is about the color red?
She said, okay, I've done a song about red. Let me get my thesaurus out and pick other ones that sound similar. This one just has a lot of nostalgia for me really specifically, because red really is a piece of my past. Like, I just had so many emotions when I listened to that. And then I feel like Taylor has a lot of feelings about that era now that she's revisited it as part of her re-records.
It's a lot about rage and trauma. Rage and trauma colliding.
Trauma and evil meeting. They made a movie about female trauma.
I think it's interesting that red is a primary color. Obviously, it's like an obvious choice. It's kind of like remedial. Like, you're a child, you only know certain colors. And then the older you get, the more nuanced your interpretation of events is, and then you can describe the differences between colors if we're talking about emotions. And she can see the difference between scarlet, red, maroon. Like, it's almost like she is maturing and singing about the same things she was singing about in the past, but with a better grasp on her own feelings and a more mature palette and what she can say and what words she can use.
Yeah, I think hindsight has done a lot for her to revisit this era. All the way back in 2012, Taylor said the color red symbolized emotions that are daring and bold and passion and love and affection. But then back in 2019, during Daylight, she revises the statement saying, "I once believed love would be burning red, but it's golden," sort of dispelling the fact that love maybe shouldn't be red. But I think with that level of hindsight, she's seeing that while it was red, there were multiple different facets, both good and bad within that. And I do think this song is about Jake Gyllenhaal, probably more so than any other song on this album. And I really wonder how she has reflected upon that relationship, having to do the re-records, you know, even going deeper into that relationship in the 10-minute version of All Too Well. How has she been left with that? There's also a really amazing line in this that I really love. It says, "The rust that grew between telephones." And I think that is a reference to the long distance relationship that she did have with Jake specifically. One of her most famous songs on Red is "Come Back Be Here," which is all about that long distance relationship and the gap that just kept getting further and further between them, and the visual of the rusted telephone where their messages were no longer really relaying or getting there is so much more mature than I think the lyrics in "Come Back Be Here" are too. So I think that all shows her growth in, you know, that 10-year period.
And I think it's incredible as well to use something so tangible like rust, which is, I guess, a shade of orange, but True. It's still, using that kind of the spectrum of explaining her feelings through different colors, I think is so nuanced. And I really also love that line. I just feel like you can feel the tension in that, like, it's growing over time. Like, rust takes a lot of time, but it grows through neglect. I was going to say, she really was holding on to swears, and there was like a swear counter for Taylor, and now she's just like, another one.
Yeah, I wonder, as the graph, it's been steadily going up ever since she put out Folklore, but I'm sure this one's like off the scale. But I do think she used it to great effect in the bridge here, and it's very punchy, and she still feels a bit annoyed at Jake, and I think to twist the knife one last time before she maybe gives up on it forever is a good one to go. And this is a really strong ending to the Red Legacy for me.
Now let's go on to track 3, Antihero. Okay, so let's start out and say you're not going to get it the first time you hear it.
You're not going to get the song the first time you hear it. After the second and third time, you're going to be like, whoa, what is this?
We did not get it the first time we heard it.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where we're both looking at each other being like, we kind of know this is the first sort of single. It's got to be good. And then we look at each other and we're like, we'll pick that up later to chat about.
I think this one will be perfect for like a full dissection, like line by line. I think there's so much nuance. There's pop culture references, there's real like diehard Taylor lyrics, like When My Depression Works the Graveyard Shift, All of the People I've Ghosted Stand There in the Room, compared to Sometimes I Feel Like Everybody Is a Sexy Baby. On first listen, I was like, she is erratic at midnight.
It felt jarring, 100%.
I also think this one greatly benefits from being the only one at time of recording that has a visual aspect to it, and what a delight that was at lunchtime today.
It was a snack. It was really good. I think it's such a fun music video, and I feel like the last music videos that Taylor has done, we've only really had Cardigan, Willow, and then the All Too Well 10 minute version music video, short film, whatever.
Award winning.
And it's really nice to see her have a little bit more fun in a music video, sort of like We're Never Getting Back Together. It's more tongue in cheek, but also does have a really serious message. Twitter will be rife with the scene of her standing on the scales, and it just whips up to the word fat, because CM bestie, that's in my bathroom as well.
Hi, fatty.
Taylor is not afraid to reference or not reference her own work as well.
And it's actually really interesting to see that Taylor has said that this is one of her favorite songs she's ever written. She struggled a lot with the idea that her life has become unmanageably sized. And I think you do see that really well in the music video, where there's a version of her that walks into a room and she's larger than life, bigger than the room, sort of Alice in Wonderland themed. That's how I thought it was originally, because she like goes to take a wee drop from the wine bottle that's so small in her hand, and I thought she's going to shrink down, but...
She's referenced Alice in Wonderland before, hasn't she?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Dan Agron's favourite movie.
And she got that tattoo covered up?
Not with the girls in the shape, Dana Agron.
Gaylers, we hear you.
But Taylor does not hear you.
Well, actually, she does hear you later on in the album.
We didn't even mention this earlier, but when the album titles were revealed, people thought Lavender Haze was going to be a lesbian anthem, her coming out story. She opened Instagram and uploaded a video in seconds that was like, this song's about Joe, period. Like, she was like, don't call me gay. Yeah, not a woman, not at all.
I have some negatives to say about this song, so get your tomatoes ready. I am a known hater of cringe Taylor, and specifically for me, some of the highs in here break me out in hives.
High.
I also have just like one word that jars for me in the chorus, and it's tea time. For me, it harkens back to London Boy, where she's saying mate and trying to, obviously she's picking up on the way Joe speaks, so I'm not being like she's just being Madonna. Like, she, I don't understand what she's saying, and I also get the nuance that tea time is like tea, like gay tea, and also like you would gossip over a pot of tea. But for me, I don't know, sometimes she just says a specific word and it takes me out. I know another example of this in this song is sometimes I feel like she really eloquently uses a thesaurus, and sometimes I think she just shoves a sentence into a song, into the beat, that doesn't really fit. For me, did you hear my covert narcissism I disguise as altruism? It feels disingenuous to me, which I know it's not, but I just feel like sometimes she wants to come across as very deep and very well-read, which I think she is. I don't think she needs to prove it by picking big words or big sayings, which I think she does again later on, which sometimes take me out of it. So don't hit me, but yeah.
I just feel like that is just a spillover from the Folklore Evermore era, where she's trying to, you know, really build up a much more serious big picture more eloquently and with bigger concept, and trying to like fit it with the synth pop sound doesn't always work. I think that's one example where it's not the best. There are other instances, for example, the line about the sexy baby, that once I dig a bit more into it, I don't mind as much, actually. It is an expression, and I didn't know this until I looked it up, so I'm not claiming to be, you know, a Tina Fey gay. I love Mean Girls, and that's about the height of it. But she borrows the phrase from an episode of 30 Rock.
And the whole sexy baby thing isn't an act. I'm a very sexy baby.
The whole thing's sort of an allegory of how she is, you know, a lot more mature in the industry. She's the monster on the hill versus these up and coming young artists like Olivia.
Don't you dare talk about Olivia.
Who else? I can't even think of like up and comers at this stage.
Eva Max.
No one says these names. Like Billie Eilish, you know, these people are really coming up for her neck. And I feel like she wants to mentor them, and she also doesn't really want to be replaced by them. And I think the imposter syndrome sometimes sets in on her, and that's maybe why she moved away from pop.
I don't think they're coming for her necks. I think they're coming for her ankles.
One final note as well that we found quite jarring in the start was the bridge, where it says, I have this dream, my daughter-in-law kills me for the money. And I think it surfaces a lot of fears that maybe her family won't even like really care for her if she doesn't leave her massive wealth to them. And that's the insecurities and the fears coming back out. But it's really entertaining to watch it in the music video. She puts in a funny little skit. Well, I think it's funny. Like her family members fighting at her funeral while she's like peeking out from inside the coffin. And now it's time for us to move over to track number 4, Snow on the Beach, featuring Lana Del Rey.
Were you silent or were you silenced?
I wonder, did she just have Lana in a basement somewhere and she recorded her from a different floor? Is Lana on this song?
I think they have like walkie-talkies and she's on the other end, but she couldn't make it to the...
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like a COVID thing. Maybe Lana had her like see-through mask on. What do you call that? Her mesh? Yeah. So Lana obviously had her mesh mask on and the vocals were struggling to get through. She's really protective against these viruses, girls.
It's a deeper and more scary topic to talk about, why Taylor will let men sing on her tracks but will put women in the background of her tracks, because she's done it consistently now. It's beyond a pattern at this point. Anyway, I'm the Lana fan of this podcast, and I was very excited for this song, and I am very disappointed in this song.
I'm glad we knew from the leaks that it was background vocals ahead of time, because then I went in with lower expectations.
Lana was the snow hitting the beach and melting immediately.
She's your Rose in like Bad Wolf Bay. Like she's on the other side trying to get through the dimension.
Taylor's like, don't come through.
Close the rift.
I just want to say, and I don't have much to say on this song, but I will say I'm immediately thrown out and angry when the song is called Snow on the Beach. And the first time the snow, the aforementioned snow is mentioned, it's in a line that says, it's like snow at the beach. Now that just annoys me. And then it threw me off. And then I'm like, Lana is whispering in the background.
I don't like that lyric either. I don't know whether it's meant to be like, it's snowing at the beach. Then once it's snowed at the beach, there is snow on the beach. The whole concept of this is essentially like you're falling in love with somebody at the same time as they're falling in love with you. It's so unrealistic and impossible that it's like when it snows at the beach.
Track 5, You're on Your Own Kid. Now Miss Taylor knows how to write a bridge.
True.
That bridge is unrelenting. It is all your insecurities, all... you, those things when you're trying to go to sleep and you're thinking of all the things you're embarrassed about that you did in the past, things that you regret, people that you're thinking about them and you're like, oh, I wonder what they're up to now, and they've pissed you off in the past, or you just felt away from them. And there's just so many, it's like a swirling like tornado of all the thoughts when you're trying so hard to go to sleep, and it's like every thought is coming at you and your brain is wide awake even though your body's trying to sleep. That's what I feel like from this song.
I agree, and I think it really encapsulates, as you say, the concept of the album being about what you think about at midnight, you know, what keeps you up at night. The bridge specifically is where I feel like the most meat of the song is too. The lyric, I host the parties and starve my body like I'd be saved by a perfect kiss, is really sad because, you know, it's really speaking about Taylor's eating disorder. Taylor talks a lot candidly about her eating disorder in Miss Americana, the documentary that's on Netflix, not sponsored. And she really goes out to say she saw a lot of pictures of herself where she was so skinny, but she felt like she had to do that to be desirable by man, desirable by the media, desirable by the public, to win all these records. And I really just feel like that was such a good way to put it into her lyrics. She's never talked about it before. I also really love the line, I looked around in a blood-soaked gown. It really gives me Carrie vibes. And I feel like maybe that takes her back to the 2009 VMAs where Kanye kind of throws the pig's blood on her. He really like embarrasses her in front of all of her peers. All the people that she looks up to at that time. She's new in the industry. She's a sexy baby. And it's just a bit unfortunate, but I'm so glad that obviously everybody rallied around her, but it shows that she still is thinking about this.
It's obviously very reminiscent of Carrie, where it's almost like the popular people are doing this to her and she's the up-and-comer, like the quiet one who's succeeding, and they think it's fun to pick on someone who's different. She's obviously coming from country music and they're like, oh, that country girl, compared to like the prom queen who's Beyonce. And I think it is a really cool reference. She is really into her referencing movies.
True.
I also appreciate the reference to Queen of Selling Turnips on Animal Crossing, Daisy May.
Well, the price is good today.
Yes.
We've already kind of alluded to it in the Reputation episode, but the track 5 is, you know, the track that Taylor deems to be the most emotional, the most pertinent to her life, and the one where she has the most difficulty sort of expressing herself on. The first time I heard it this morning, I was almost a bit unsure whether it qualified to be the track 5, but really dissecting the lyrics in that bridge so specifically, I can totally see why. I feel like this doesn't actually just be the track 5 for this era. This could be the track 5 of her career to date, and I really find that beautiful. She also shared in the New York University commencement speech all the way back in May 2022 that not being invited to the parties and sleepovers in my hometown made me feel hopelessly lonely. But because I felt alone, I would sit in my room and write the songs that would get me a ticket to somewhere else. And she also says, the scary news is you're on your own now. But the cool news is you're on your own now. And that is so punchy in a way to sum up that song. And she teased it back in May.
It's so cool to give the illusion that the song is bad, that you're on your own. And then you flip it to be like, all those things that happen to you to make you better, to make you grow. But at night, it's almost like they come back to haunt you and hurt you again and again, even if you in the daytime have come to terms with things. There's something so interesting about the later you stay up, the more those memories and thoughts creep in, even things that you've shut off from your own normal memory. And I just think that the ending is so amazing and all-encompassing.
Yeah, it's a brilliant song. I think it is so good, and I'm really glad it's in the collection of track 5s. Track 6, Midnight Rain. Good morning, Tom Hiddleston. We're talking about you. I just didn't realize we were getting a Getaway Car sequel on this album, and I'm so glad we've got one. I say wearing my Getaway Car embroidered sweatshirt right now recording this.
I manifested it by purchasing that.
Yes, thank you so much, Pete. I really love it. I think even jumping into this song, the intro is so jarring to me. It's like almost hyper-pop-ish with the like vocoder or something. I'm not sure that's the right way to describe it, but it comes in quite sharp.
I like it. It feels like rain on a window or something.
Oh, like muffled that you mm-hmm. can't really fully hear it.
Yeah.
I love that.
I'm always so different when listening to music to Paul, where he listens to lyrics before the song and I listen to the song before the lyrics. So I always don't get it the first time I hear it. So looking at the lyrics, it's so explicitly about Tom Hiddleston. And I think that's such a nice comparison to the rage and hurt that she feels from other relationships, whereas this seems to be the one that she seems the most guilty based on the fact that he was nothing but nice to her, but she knew he wasn't right.
Exactly. I really do feel like Tom Hiddleston and Taylor Lautner are like the ones where, you know, in the Venn diagram of like Taylor was kind of in the wrong, the men were in the wrong, Dan Agron's in the middle, like, you know.
Whipping.
Yeah, she's taking a much higher level of accountability for her involvement in these breakups, I feel, compared to Jake Gyllenhaal or John Mayer. Spoiler.
I think the line, he wanted it comfortable, I wanted that pain, is so impactful because Tom's clearly just a nice guy, Mr. Loki. He just wanted a nice girlfriend, a nice wife, a nice bride, as she says in the next line. But she kind of wanted the pain. It's almost like when you come out of a relationship where you're so angry, you just want to be treated like shit a bit because you're so used to that and you just want to feel something after coming out of something that must have completely wrecked her.
Yeah, and I just feel bad for Tom that in every sort of song that's about him, there's a double edge of like, fuck you, Calvin. Like one last little stab to him because he was so bad to her. I feel like the last like outro is a good end to this sort of Tom Hiddleston storyline too, where she says, you know, I guess sometimes we all get just what we wanted. You know, she gets her happy relationship with Joe when she needed it. He's engaged right now to someone else too. You know, he really has sort of sorted out his life. He's got his own Disney Plus show. He's doing really good. And then the last part of the song kind of gets me, where she says, and I never think of him except on midnights like this. And again, that concept of the album being, you know, when you go to bed, your mind brings you places you didn't even know you were going to go. And I feel like her referring to herself as Midnight Rain too in this, where, you know, she's just that, she was that storm in the nighttime, shows that at midnight, some things are quite negative.
Especially when she's comparing herself to him and he's bright, sunshine, smiley, what people want an actor to be outside the role. And she, at that time, just felt like she couldn't just be the nice, pretty, smile, wave girlfriend that he needed her to be or wanted her to be at that time. Obviously, the most iconic photos of them as a couple is them playing in the ocean with Tom wearing an I Heart TS t-shirt. The line in verse one of the song, jumping off things in the ocean, obviously is signaling to everyone, this is Tom and I broke his heart because he was nice. It just feels like wrong person, wrong time, but not in the way that she usually does emote about. I feel like she does kind of hold Tom to the side when singing about men, not that Taylor sings only about men and past relationships, but I think Getaway Car and this are kind of like fuck you, not a you did me wrong or I did you wrong. It's just like a, we shouldn't have done this, but I hope you're happy, I hope I'm happy, but I don't sit up at night thinking about you. Track 7, Question. Paul, can I ask you a question?
Is the bus still running?
Did you ever have someone kiss you in a crowded room? Answer that question truthfully.
No. Genuinely no.
I wish this song had different questions and not the same question that is so many words in one sentence.
That's called question, not questions.
Dot, dot, dot. I know she does say, can I ask you a question, but can she spice up the question? I don't know what this song is about. We have a theory that it's about Harry.
Yeah, and I really don't want to get into the business of attributing each song to a different person or like a different guy, but this one does feel a bit like that, just because that I remember at the start, which again is kind of muffled, more like a memory to me in this one actually than like the rain in the window, is, you know, the exact hook from Out of the Woods, which is all about Harry Styles from 1989.
It could be that that little snippet is like she doesn't really think about him, but then when she hears the song that she knows she wrote about him, then if like, if she's in like Walmart and they're playing Out of the Woods, then she's like, oh fuck, remember that?
I'd love to shop at that Walmart.
I don't know.
What is Walmart? It's like they sell wall stuff.
Okay, so I think we're going to be a bit more negative about this one. So I want to call out the lyric that I really like before we go there. I really love when she says, I don't remember who I was before you painted all my nights a color I've searched for since. I think that's beautiful. It's also a line she's pretty much already used in Illicit Affairs. But that's okay. I think it's still really nice.
Why are friends making fun of you and then waiting a full 15 seconds, then they start clapping? And then when she inserts, or Jack inserts, the stock sound of people clapping and cheering, It really, it's giving me tease of me putting in a random soundbite and being like, ooh, we're the snappies.
Yeah. Why were they kissing for 15 seconds and then everyone was clapping? Like, there was a full journey of like booing to kissing.
It's like those memes where it's like, I stood up in class and I said super hulock and everyone started clapping. There's a little bridge here. There's a little bridge where she's talking about how once you've found the one, Then everyone else kind of feels like meh, even if this is about Harry and she's supposed to have felt so lucky to be with him. Now she's found Joe. It's just like, okay.
Yeah, I think it's about like when everybody else pales in comparison to your soulmate, and that's nice, but the chorus just is a bit airy-fairy, and by the third time it comes around, I'm like, oh, I don't want to hear about this question again.
Yeah, I'm like, do not ask me a question. This isn't an interview. Look at my CV.
Track 8, Vigilante Shit. This is Reputation Light. Like, no, Reputation 0.5.
It's the Coke Zero. to the reputation of Pepsi Max.
Please don't, because Coke Zero is so much better than Pepsi Max.
This is not up for debate.
But for real, this could be on the vault of reputation for me. I'm glad it isn't. But
stay in the vault.
Keep the vault locked. I'm definitely whelmed by this song in particular. I was expecting it to be a really I Did Something Bad follow-up, and I feel like there is tease of that. But if anything, this is a sequel to Bad Guy by Billie Eilish to me, in like kids bop form.
Oh. They can't hear me because they're listening to kids bop.
I don't dislike it that much, but that was shitty.
I think it just doesn't really go anywhere. I think lyrically it goes somewhere, obviously, which we're going to talk about, but I just think it feels like she's staying at the same level, which I get that she's trying to portray that she's so past annoyed that she's just like, I'm out for revenge and I'm going to do what I need to do. I'm not going to get mad. I'm not going to give you the reaction you want. I'm going to give you nothing and be a sniper from the side.
And to us, this song really is about Scooter Braun. Boo.
Boo, tomato, tomato, tomato.
Enemy of all podcasts worldwide, I believe. there are multiple different lines in here. And if you don't know who Scooter Braun is, A, you're lucky, and B, he is the he is a person who acquired the masters to Taylor's first six albums in a deal with her former publisher, Big Machine. And that is the reason why Taylor is re-recording her first six albums. But in 2021, Scooter, who needed to get back on his scooter,
where is your scooter? Where is it?
Was sued for $200 million by Goldman Sachs executive under claims of fraud and breach of contract, following false promises of fulfillment on a development of a private equity fund. But I really love in the third verse, she says, well, he was doing lines, not on the beach, and crossing all of mine. Someone told his white collar crimes to the FBI. That's hot to me. And I feel like that's a prelude to karma, where she's like, justice will happen when it needs to happen. All our enemies sort of fall on their swords.
For me, this felt from the first second like it was a little bit of TikTok fodder for me. And I was right. Go to TikTok. Let's get everyone to do a cat eye and give like vigilante shit, and then like, she can see the Instagram captions, I'm on my vigilante shit. And then I go to TikTok, she's already done it, I'm like, I see you, marketing it's genius.
It's a good TikTok.
Oh, she looks amazing.
Last thing on this one, I really enjoy the lyric as well. I don't dress for villains or for innocence. And for us deep Swifties, we know that on Speak Now, the song Innocence is a song of forgiveness to enemy of the podcast number two, Kanye West. And I love that little shade, just in one line there, it's effective. She's not overselling it. Even on Speak Now, I think it's so shady where she's like, eh, I forgive you in a song. He didn't ask, but she forgave him anyway.
Track 9, Bejeweled. So obviously this song is about the famous app Bejeweled, available in the App Store.
Please.
This is another one which is a lot of thinking about what it's actually about. We have our theories, but I just need to get my annoyance out at her shoving in another saying, familiarity breeds contempt, is so randomly placed in the chorus for me. I'm not saying it's not relevant to the song. It just feels like so many syllables. It's like she loves to be like, blah, 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 blah. That seems like a read, but what's the song about to you, Paul?
See, I like that line a bit more because I like the delivery of it more. I understand some of the other songs that it maybe doesn't go to the beat, but I like the way the melody kind of switches up there. And then she says about like the basement, like you're putting me in the basement, but I really want to be in the penthouse of your heart. And I feel like it's a really good song about like when someone tries to dim your shine, literally. It's not very subtle, I don't think. Does feel to me like a bit of a read about Calvin, you know, like sort of the inverse of Midnight Rain, where she's saying, sorry, Tom, but she's now back to being like shining a light. Again, another pun on, you know, the mistreatment maybe she received from Calvin, or certainly she believes that. I really like the line as well where she's like, oh, and I really like the line where she says, when I meet the band, they ask, do I have a man? And I could still say, I don't remember. That's shitty. She's like, I don't know about that anymore. And I also feel like that might be a reference to the fact that he went up on the podium and for to accept an award and he doesn't say her name. I feel like it's part of that too, where she's like, oh, you forget me, well, I don't remember you either.
Oh, does he say five names? It could be that he only names five people when he's accepting his award and Taylor's not even in the top five people of his mind. I originally took it as a MySpace reference of like being in your top eight. But I think from the first verse, I felt like it was from a more juvenile perspective, because I guess I thought that first. But I do think it is about coming out of an abusive relationship or a emotionally taxing relationship and being like, oh, look, I can wear what I want, do what I want, and no one's going to tell me off or shut me down, and I can just like sparkle.
Yeah, and it's a nice comparison to Mirrorball, where she can also just go out and shine and reflect and be such a beacon of hope for people, even if she doesn't feel like it inside. I think the production's cute, the lyrics are cute, it's a cute song, sort of falls in the middle of Midnights for me, but I do appreciate its inclusion on the list. Track 10, Labyrinth. Who knew that Taylor Swift was such a Hilary Duff stan? Hands up. My hand's raised. Because if you've listened to our Reputation episode, the very first episode of our podcast, you will know that we noted a weird fact where Taylor may have pinched a few lyrics from Hilary Duff's song Breathe In, Breathe Out, and she is at it again. In the song, she says, breathe in, breathe through, breathe deep, breathe out. I've only got one thing to say, Taylor.
Get a good lawyer.
Taylor also quoted this lyric in her commencement speech at New York University months before the release of Midnights, where she says, hard things will happen to us. We will recover. We will learn from it. We will grow more resilient because of it. And as long as we are fortunate enough to be breathing, we will breathe in, breathe through, breathe deep, and breathe out.
It's very clear from the pre-chorus in this song that she is so used to things not working out for her, and she compares it to being afraid of an elevator, where she is painfully aware that everything that comes up must come down, and she is obviously feeling like everything's going right and she's so lost because she's waiting for the drop every day. She's waking up, and then I feel like the metaphor is that the labyrinth is in her mind and then Joe is like leading her through the labyrinth, or at least with her in the labyrinth.
Yeah.
So she can have someone to hold on to even if she is still lost in her brain. And like, being with the perfect person doesn't make your life perfect. Being together is better than feeling lost alone.
Right, I agree. I feel like labyrinth is a good, again, message for the fact that she's in bed sometimes at midnight thinking about all these things, and she's so lost in her mind maze. Katy Perry reference. Witness will still not be on Snapped, but, you know, we gotta give her props where they are. She was inspired. No one's ever said this. But yeah, it's a cute song about being in love with Joe Alwyn. Do I think we needed another one? No, but we got one.
Now for track 11, Karma. So this is the best song on the album.
Karma is a bop.
It's incredible. I feel like I'm there in that video of her in the red era where she's getting everyone to wave their arms. That's me. The first time we heard it, I was like, yes.
Yeah, that was shaking. Just from that. So there's a theory, the Swifties like to have theories, that Karma was an album that she was planning on releasing in 2016. Taylor had really scheduled all of her releases from her albums every 2 years, starting from 2006, all the way up to 1989 and 2014. And then we were expecting an album in 2016. It didn't come. The Kanye drama was swirling, and there are rumors that Taylor had intended to release her sixth studio album, Karma, in 2016. I don't really fully believe that, because I don't know why she would have had an album called Karma if it wasn't about Kanye.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Reputation is the natural next step, but a lot of people think it. And Taylor knows that it's a big theory, which is why, like, in the Man music video, again, you'll remember that there was, like, all the different albums that Scooter stole from her on the wall. Taylor as a man is like pissing on them, and then the word Karma is in the very middle, and everyone's like, oh my god, is that gonna be the next album? Is it a lost album? And then when we're just watching Midnight's Mayhem with me, she rolls around the little cage ball, out pops a song called Karma, and she's like laughing at us because she knows how important this concept is to us and how much we've been waiting for it. And I'm so glad she just put her whole Taylor Swift right into it. It's such a good song.
I love how the rhythm of the song is almost like a nursery rhyme. It's kind of like juvenile, like, haha, like, I've got this. All those things you try to take from me, well, I actually have everything and you have nothing. And it's not even like a vengeance song. It's just like a everything worked out for me despite you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I've seen a lot of people online today say, oh, this could have been on Reputation. I don't really actually agree with that. I think theming wise it fits in that era, but it's almost like she's looking back at that era and saying, I won. Mm-hmm. Which is different than Reputation, where she hadn't like played out the full events yet.
Yeah.
But I do fully agree. It is a song all about how, you know, she won when she met Joe Alwyn. The lyric at the end where she's like, karma is the guy on the screen coming straight home to me, is like, it's a punch for me in the song.
Yes, and we just found out that Spider Boy isn't her shouting out Spider Man, but is actually SB for Scooter Braun.
Like, her mind works in mysterious ways, and the Swifties who identify these things work in even weirder ways. Yeah, and I just really like the bridge too of the song. Like, the way the breakdown goes is like she's sort of hunting too, like the way the production like sort of falls away, and it's like the rhythm is very like she's on the hunt. And even the lyrics in there too, where she's saying, you know, karma's on your scent like a bounty hunter, karma's gonna track you down. It feels like really ominous, which I then think maybe should have came before Vigilante shit, where she's talking about like Scooter getting investigated by the FBI and all that stuff. But I think they go really well hand in hand, and I would like to see this represented in a visual album if that's what we're gonna get.
Oh, 100%.
Track 12, Sweet Nothing. This track really feels like it could be the Invisible String-esque song from this album. Important to point out at the very start, I guess, that Joe Alwyn / William Bowery wrote this song with Taylor, which is really nice. Like, it's a really cute love song between the two of them, that Taylor's sort of talking through a really small day in their relationship where they find something small, but it means a lot to them. And
I think a key part of this song is the fact that sweet nothings are things that your partner does for you that make you feel loved and are just like cozy, like kisses and things like that. But the song is called Sweet Nothing, singular, and the wordplay is all about how she feels like that even when he does nothing, even when he's standing in the kitchen humming, like she feels at home compared to the outside. I really love the first verse where she's telling about this pebble and like, have you ever wanted to be a pebble more in your life?
Yeah, I just want to be in her pocket, nice and cozy with Joe there too. It's cute.
I think also in the second verse when she's talking about how she wrote a poem, and I think it's like a really short, it's a really short verse, but it really just shows that he sees her more than she feels anyone's ever seen her. Even in that bit where she says, I wrote a poem and you say, what a mind. This happens all the time. So she's like, this isn't like, oh, one time he said something really nice about me. It's a continuous thing in their relationship where they really build each other up and have nothing but nice things and supportive things to say for each other.
And I think it goes well against Antihero, where there's so much self-doubt, so much uncertainty, so many insecurities where she's not sure whether she's actually still good at this job or still has much value to add. And Joe clearly makes her feel really valued. And it's just a beautiful love song.
Yeah, it's a bit twee, but it's a nice addition to the chaos from other points in her midnights that sometimes Taylor goes to sleep knowing that she's loved and supported and happy with who she's with. And just because you're lying awake at midnight doesn't mean you have to be self-deprecating. Track 13, the final track on the original album, Mastermind. So do you think Taylor and Joe are in love or not really?
Just at midnight.
I do like this one because it really is just showing that she was sick of letting life happen to her and letting all whatever happens happens with men. And she was like, no, I fancy him and I'm gonna get him, and like, I don't care what happens because I want what I want and I got it and then it worked out. So now she's like, TM, a mastermind.
Yeah, it is like an expansion of karma in that way. I really like this song. I find it like complex in Taylor's discography for me to think about it though, because it's like she has Paper Rings and then really explicitly Invisible String that seem to be more around like fate is why we're together, and the first verse also really supports that. And then that's why I really think the chorus is clever when she's like, no, actually not true. All those things were lies. Like, actually I was a mastermind. And like at the very end of the song, she sort of switches it where she's like, oh, Joe, I'm the mastermind. She finally confides in Joe and Joe smiles and says, I already knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like a little plot twist in the song itself
But then I feel like it is a plot twist for those other songs too, and I really enjoy that aspect of it.
I like it as an album closer, but Paul was a bit more of a different opinion.
Right. I do really, really like this song. For me, I don't really see it as the ending of this story. The album is all about different reflections, and to have Sweet Nothing and then this be about how much she loves Joe, I don't really know if that's what the message is trying to get across.
Well, it was only the album closer for 1 hour, so.
True. She really, like, you know, reverse corded it and just was like, oh, actually in the middle of the pack.
And I wonder if it's almost like a little bit of guilt that she's like, I would rather this had happened by fate. Like, it would be nicer for it as a story. But then she's like sitting there at night going, would this have happened if I didn't go for it, you know?
I really like that as an interpretation of it. And it is all about how those big songs like Delicate are telling her story, but now she's finally able to tell her real story to the whole world, because there's nothing wrong with knowing what you want and going to get it. You know, clearly she saw him at the Met Gala, really fancied him, and then we're not sure the details, orchestrated a date with them. And I just think that's nice.
And I kind of love the beat.
The beat's so good. It feels like very video gamey to me, like 8-bit or like 16-bit, those older sort of soundtracks, and I really love that.
But that's why I think it seems like it's like the last song of a movie. Like, I feel like it's like the sunset, it's like the credits rolling.
Yes, I do see that now, to be fair. I'm really on board with that. It does feel like the credits, and then like the 3 a.m. songs could be the post-credit sequences, maybe.
Yes, so the clock is ticking on, isn't it?
True, we're now at 3 a.m. and we're going in with track number 14, The Great War. So this is the first of these 3 a.m. songs, and it feels like maybe between midnight and 3 a.m. Aaron Dessner woke up from his sleep and got involved, because it's really strange that Aaron Dessner, the key collaborator in Evermore and co-collaborator of Folklore, isn't present at all in the first 13 songs. I wonder why she did that.
Maybe he lives in a different time zone. He's British. No, I don't know if he is.
I don't think he is, but it's fine. He was asleep anyway, but he woke up and delivered a really strong song for me here to kick off this new batch of songs. If you like Stay, Stay, Stay from Red, I feel like this is the adult version. All about a relationship where you're fighting, you're arguing, but you realize that it's actually better to go through it together, hand in hand, versus battling each other.
I love, again, her use of colour in this song, even starting out with My Knuckles Were Bruised Like Violets, and we're starting the main album with Lavender Haze to show the kind of honeymoon phase of love, and now you're looking down at your knuckles from fighting so much, and it's the same colour, purple, but a different hue. Again, also, and then the chorus, we're talking about crimson, red, to show that the previous relationship, which we all know about, was red, and now you're seeing the signs of that kind of in fighting and not necessarily being unhappy, but clashing, but you know that it's the person you're supposed to be with, so you're allowed to fight. But I think the thing I don't like about Taylor, where she's using the thesaurus, I don't feel like this at all. I think this is every single word is on purpose. Everything has a point. I think it's like a poem, literally. Unfortunately, we did war poetry in GCSE, but I don't feel like it's like that. I wish it was like this in GCSE.
True, we would be getting a nice start. Well, we still would be.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'll pull out the records. Not me having to post my receipts on SnapPaw and Instagram. I think she works better as a songwriter on the whole with Aaron Dessner, because he gets her more into the feel of it. And Jack, sometimes, I'm not like slandering Jack, he does really great work with her, but sometimes the visuals have to be too on the nose.
Yeah,
they're, I agree, a little bit direct for me with Jack. But Jack's a genius, there's no doubt about it. But Aaron has the subtlety and the world building, which I love. And I'm so glad we got more of these songs here. I actually really particularly enjoy the way that they change the vows in each of the choruses. So in the first chorus, she vows that she won't cry anymore. Then it escalates to, in the second verse, that she won't fight anymore, with the final chorus then saying, I vowed I would always be yours. So there's sort of like a promise of forever. Probably will not help the theories that her and Joe already married, but even if they're not, I think they've definitely committed to be with each other forever. And I really love the honesty, if this song is about Joe, about having an actual argument with the person, as you say, that you're meant to be in love with forever. Like, it's not going to be perfect, but once you see the other person's hurt, the priority is making them feel better, which I think this song does a good job of, like the honesty or that sort of thing.
I think it also really starts off the theming of 3 a.m. because at that point, you know, you're lying beside the person you love.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about, why do we fight? Like, they're asleep beside you, like they're the hand that reaches out for you, but you're still allowed to have those thoughts, especially when you're trying to get over and you're beside someone who's snoring away and you're like, why are we fighting?
Definitely snoring. Anyways.
Yeah, and we've got a special shout out to the second verse because it's literally amazing.
It's beautiful. Yeah, a lot of really descriptive imagery here. I really particularly love the line, and maybe it's the past that's talking, screaming from a crypt, tell me to punish you for things you never did. I think there's a lot in there around your past traumas coming in and saying, oh, I should be annoyed at this person, but they're not the same. They won't make the same mistakes. They won't treat you as badly, you know. But sometimes you can't help but take it out on them at the same time.
I really like the start of the verse where it's, you drew up some good faith treaties. I drew curtains closed, drank my poison all alone. Mm-hmm. Very much showing that sometimes you're with someone who processes things different to you and they're trying to make it right, and what you need is to just go be by yourself and play with your inner saboteur for a second, but at the end of the day you reach your hand for them in the bed.
Okay, this is turning into a therapy session.
Which one's which?
Tag yourself.
Track 15, Bigger Than the Whole Sky. So initially when I heard this song, I interpreted it as a breakup song. And upon closer reflection and speaking to one of my friends in work about it, she actually messaged me to say, do you think it's about a miscarriage? And for me, that has completely changed my viewpoint on this song, and I can't really unhear it, especially with words like, I'm never gonna meet, what could have been, would have been, what should have been, you, what could have been, would have been you. It's very much signaling to me that it's someone that never got to exist.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I couldn't be for sure, and I don't want to make assumptions, but for me it's very stuck in my brain now
I agree. Again, I hadn't read it like that. When you said it to me, I can't hear it differently. We're not trying to say that like this has happened to Taylor specifically. She does normally write from things she can remember. But digging into things like Folklore Evermore, she was speaking about some fictional things. So we're not saying this is definitely what happened to Taylor. But certainly, I feel like this song is about saying goodbye to someone who never got a chance to meet, who didn't exist. And I can't think of any other scenario other than a miscarriage. I also feel like the line in verse 2 is quite potent when you think about it. It says, did some force take you because I didn't pray? And Taylor has talked a few times, not a lot, about her religious upbringing. I mean, as a country artist, that's always embedded and baked into what you're doing and what you're saying. I mean, there was a homophobic version of Picture to Burn. She should have burned that picture and burned that version. But, you know, so I'm sure there is some element of faith in there too that she never really talks about, and it's good to see that in this song. It makes it more interesting to me. It makes it stand out. And also then within the last song, The Great War, in the bridge it says, it turned into something bigger, which now links so clearly to this song for me, you know, in terms of that her unborn child potentially is bigger than the whole sky. The love for that person is more than you could ever imagine. Is that a reference to it? I don't know. Don't want to push any further, but it definitely really changed how I look at the song, and I definitely enjoy it a lot more now as well. Track 16, Paris. So do you think she's in love with Joe Alwyn?
Are you happy to be in Paris?
Oui.
My least favorite version of Taylor is present at the start of this song. There's something about when she really over explains something, like, your ex-friend's sister. I don't know why it annoys me. I love you, Taylor, but the start at that first verse, I'm like, what? She's rapid fire telling me facts. I'm like, I thought we were in Paris.
Yeah, I totally agree. I read this a lot as if this is Midnight's version of I Knew Places or Out of the Woods, that sort of song around running away, not being in the media spotlight, and sort of just being with the person that you love outside of all of this circus. There's a specific lyric in the bridge where it says, "Let the only flashing lights be the tower at midnight," referring to the Eiffel Tower that lights up at midnight. Again, another Midnight reference tick, but also getting away from the paparazzi, the flashing lights, and just being somewhere together, especially Paris, the most romantic city in the whole world.
It's definitely that thing where you go on a trip with someone and they kind of become synonymous with the place for you. She clearly went to Paris, and now if she ever goes to Paris again, she's going to remember this trip with little quotes like, in an alleyway drinking champagne, we drew a map on your bedroom ceiling. She really just got away from the life that she was used to and just had like a mini adventure with Joe, and no one knew and no one saw, or no one invaded her privacy, and she just lived like a local.
And if you remember when Lover comes out, she does a Disney Plus special, again not sponsored, of different songs from Lover, and they're all on Spotify. So maybe she associates singing those songs live for the first time with Joe and with Paris, and sort of linking that all together. There's also a line, "I confess my truth in swooping, sloping, cursive letters," which aligns to the Lover typeface, which is in the front of the Lover album and in the Me! Exclamation mark music video, if anyone cares to traumatize themselves to watch.
Track 17, High Infidelity. Did Taylor say a slur on April 29th?
She's sick of you Gaylers. She literally is so sick of you Gaylor supporters that she's like, if I have to say the F word or a slur, I'll do it.
Quickly check Dan Agron's birthday. It better not be April 29th.
No, no. But I think the biggest intrigue of this entire song is, do you really want to know what I was doing on April 29th? And I think a lot of people are pointing out that Calvin Harris's song with Rihanna, This Is What You Came For, which was penned by Taylor / Neil Slowberg, came out on April 29th. Sort of seems as though she wasn't there for the release or the release party or anything like that. Maybe she was out doing something else, we don't know. The song kind of infers that she's out with somebody else, maybe emotionally already kind of past Calvin, not really sure. But also on April 29th, 2012, Taylor was at Dana Agron's birthday party. Munching and crunching.
Chains and whips exciter.
She was getting whipped. She was wearing that t-shirt where she's like, I'm queer. Taylor was screaming.
No.
For Taylor's lawyers listening, she was not wearing that t-shirt. Just to be clear, it's a joke.
Other than that, I really do like the melody of the chorus for sure, but I don't know, this is probably the weakest 3 a.m. track. Don't know if that's controversial.
I would agree. Not to spoil it, but I also probably would skip Glitch if I really had to cut songs. It would probably be this and Glitch from the full album. Because I don't really feel like this one goes anywhere. I really love the lyric, "Do I really have to chart the constellations in his eyes?" Because she talks about Joe's eyes in Call It What You Want, like as stars. So
I think we're just gonna have to deal with a lot of gays posting a shirtless photo next April 29th saying, do you really want to know where I was April 29th, and the answer being the gym.
Track 18, Glitch. So do you think Taylor's in love with Joel?
Not Taylor in her Missing No era,
because he's a glitch. I got it. Not Joel being trapped underneath the van in Brilliant City. Is that what it is?
Not him having a pebble in his pocket and 999 rare candies.
Talking to the old man. Oh my goodness. This is my least favorite song of the whole album.
In verse 2 of the song, it says, but it's been 2,190 days of our love blackout. Now, we do love blackout.
True.
But 2,190 days ago from today was October 22nd, 2016. Which I'm sure something happened that day, but it was National Colour Day, National Make a Dog's Day, Key Lime Green. I think the number of days is the only memorable thing about the song.
Agreed.
Can you tell us a bit more about how there's been a tease of this glitch before?
I don't even know if the two are linked, but it seems like potentially they are. So essentially, all the way back in June of 2021, we'll all remember Taylor posted the Wildest Dreams, Taylor's version TikTok, where she's doing like a weird transition, like romantic zoom in. And in between the two shots, there's a weird glitch. And everybody for like the last year and a bit were like, what's the glitch? Why is the screen doing that? She was teasing this song.
Keep it in the vault. Track 19, the penultimate track, Would've, Could've, Should've. So this is a very heavy song and has a lot of religious imagery. It honestly really reminds me of Demi's 29.
Totally similar themings in terms of the age gap between the two.
And how there's such a clarity that comes to you when you are older and you become the age or close enough to the person who took advantage of you, and you put yourself in their perspective and go, why did that? Why was that allowed to happen, especially for women?
Exactly. And this really is a direct reference to Taylor's relationship with John Mayer, which she was in when she was 19 and John Mayer was 32. So exactly to your point, Taylor's currently 32 right now. Reflecting back on all of that, it's really not right. This song is scathing to me. Mm-hmm. They're really putting John Mayer on blast, who probably thought he was fine until Speak Now, Taylor's version came out. Again, Swifties will know that there's a pretty deep, probably until this song, I would say her darkest and most cutting song is Dear John, the track 5 from that album. A lot of people I've seen online were hoping for an extended version of that song on the Taylor's version, really similar to Jake Gyllenhaal, who had to suffer 5 more minutes talking about his experience in All Too Well in that version. If people wanted an extended version of Dear John, they have it here. This is part 2. This is the re-up, the remix, the attack. And it's really sad to listen to.
The way her voice like warbles over the word 19, I don't know, it's like religious to me. It's like a religious song. I don't know. There's a lot of imagery with like the stained glass, the being on your knees. It just, dancing with the devil, obviously. It just feels like a crisis of faith that she's having to still have, and she is never getting over it. And she says that the tomb won't close.
Yeah.
So she is self-aware that she's never going to be able to come to terms with this and package it up in a box and be like, I know that happened to me and that's fine. And I think it is brave to sing about it. And I think it's brave to even show that at one point she says, and the God's honest truth is the pain was heaven. So all I can say is it's a crisis of faith. She was clearly more religious when she was younger.
Yeah.
And things like that can break your faith, not only in humanity, but with a higher power.
And she got a lot of flack. It wasn't as if at the time John Mayer was under scrutiny for being in a relationship. They both got a lot of hate for being in a relationship with each other. And the line in this song, if I never blushed, then they could have never whispered about this. I know a lot of people think that like, Joe Jonas was the first really public relationship she had and was the first one that then people were saying she was bottling up men to use in songs. I would say that Speak Now, people thought she did that even more. With a song called Dear John, it was such a just a letter of everything. You know, John cuts her off. It even says in this song something around you tried to erase us. And then she writes the song Dear John to be like, well, if you're not going to take my call, if you're not going to listen to me, then here's everything written down. Mm-hmm. And the world will hear it.
Yeah,
and that song is so strong for somebody who, you know, was only 20 at the time. I can't believe she wrote that at the time. This feels almost the best lyrically for me of the entire album. Initially, I was really surprised it was on the 3 a.m. version of the album and not in the main Midnight's album itself. But the more I've reflected on it, well, first of all, I think this is a hint that she's already recorded Speak Now.
Okay.
And she's processing through all of that trauma and that pain when we were recording Dear John. And then this is like, well, here's what I would say if I was writing that song right now. And B, then I was thinking, okay, well, this feels like it should be track 5. Really emotional. But I maybe think she doesn't want to give him another one, you know, to his credit, and give him that weight. But also, it's track 19. She was 19 years old when the relationship was occurring. I feel like this all is just such a sign of, like, if you're not sure who this is about, well, I don't need to call it Dear John again. Track 20, the final track. Dear Reader. We've made it, Dear Reader, to the last song. I know we talked a lot earlier around whether Mastermind was, like, a good last song for the album. I think this is the perfect last song for an album. Probably my favourite ending of an album for her. I don't think it's as good as New Romantics 1989. Don't Come For Me. That's my favourite Taylor song. But this really encapsulates the themings of the album for me. I also find it really interesting this comes right after a song expanding on Dear John, being called Dear Reader. Like something I just, my brain was putting together. It also references Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, in which the final stanza of the novel states, Dear Reader, I married him. With this also being the beginning of the end of the message for this album. And also another reason she could be married to Joe. You know, like a subtle little twist in there. Probably not, but like, if she was going to announce she was married, this would be pretty camp.
I think there's, I mean, first of all, I agree. Second of all, I think there's something, I don't know how to word this. I think there's something about drink in this. I think the way she, like the vocal effect, like warbles on never take advice from someone who's falling apart. And then in the last, or in the bridge, she's talking about her fourth drink in her hand. I don't know if this is like the clarity you have when you're at 3 a.m. and you're drunk and you're reflecting. You're being like, it's almost like she's talking to her younger self, or talking to fans of her, people who relate to her, people who relate to the things that have happened to her in her life. And it's kind of like, you know, when you're at a party and you're drunk and you're just talking about life.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Because I think it is very concise. It's very like a good, it's a very well written love letter to someone. But I also think there's something about the vocal effects, something about the fact that we know it's 3 a.m. It's like the end of the party. It's the end of the show, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the vocal effects to me were more around like self-doubt and insecurities maybe taking over, and her real voice is getting like submerged with the sort of warbling, as you say, or like that like effect in the background is starting to like come back into the forefront, like it was in Midnight Rain as well. This is really a song where Taylor relays all the advice from her career, but also it sort of seems like she's telling the public and her fans maybe not to look at her so strongly for the beacons of truth for all their questions and answers, that she's a person too. The lyrics in the outro super specifically are, you should find another guiding light while I shine so bright. She's sort of saying like, it's hard not to look at me because when I step out, everybody sees me. She's so bright, but maybe not necessarily the right role model, because I don't think anybody, you know, she's only 32 years of age. Should she be a role model for millions and millions of people? Probably not. I don't think that's fair to put on anybody's shoulders. I think she said in the past, you know, when she dresses in the morning, she's dressing for a million people and thinking about what a million people are going to think.
I think this also plays hand in hand with Antihero.
True.
Of like knowing that she thinks not so highly of herself, and everyone is critiquing every move she makes, and every decision she makes will impact the youth, or the weight that you have to hold on you because you're going to impact someone else's life. Even if you're having a shitty day, then you've impacted so many fans, so many people.
I think that's a difficulty in becoming so famous. I don't think she had this issue in Fearless and Speak Now, even when she was selling a million records in 1 week. The hype and scrutiny around her really only started when she moved into pop, which is interesting and disappointing. And Miss Americana, the documentary, I've talked about it before on our podcast. Definitely watch it if you haven't already checked it out. It just shows you what a human being Taylor is, if you don't already get it from these songs, which I think it does come across really well. And I really love it as an ending for the whole album as well.
So that is Midnight's 3 a.m. edition. And I've honestly really enjoyed going through each song. I love talking about songs and really understanding the depth of the song. Even though I admitted at the start of the episode that I really prefer the music rather than the lyrics, but then once I connect something to the lyrics, then I can be like, oh, that's the one about that. It makes the song sound different and I like it. But again, as we said, we are only in the early stages of digesting this album, and obviously more things are going to come out. But the first thing any Swiftie wants to know is, when are we going to see her on tour, Paul?
Lord only knows, but I know that the girls are ready. It's going to be the Great War. Genuinely to try and get these tickets. I mean, there was like a weird announcement of, if you pre-order the album in the UK before the 21st of October, you'll get a pre-sale link to the next tour, which could be anything and anytime and anywhere. You know, it's like Squid Game. And I would get in. I would be in a Squid Game, cutting out my cookie. But what do I want the tour to be? It's a question I ask myself every midnight, to be honest. I don't know.
And 3 a.m.
And 5 a.m. every part of the night. Because she needs to tour Lover. Well, does she? I don't know. She needs a tour Lover, Folklore, Evermore, Fearless Taylor's Version, Red Taylor's Version, Midnight's 3 a.m. edition, question mark around Speak Now, Reputation, Taylor's Version, 1999 Taylor's Version, Debut Taylor's Version. What is she going to do? I really don't know what her options are. She only has a 2-hour slot. And she's got one song that's 10 minutes.
Bring it on.
I really would like her to do, I think, like a Greatest Hits tour called Taylor's Version Tour, or Tour Taylor's Version, or something like that, where she can pull her favourites. But, you know, some, like, everybody's going to be missing out on a song they really want to hear. Another thing I think she could do, but I don't think she's going to do, would be mini residencies, kind of like Harry's doing with Harry's House, or Gaga did with the Jazz Version and the Enigma. I feel as though she could do, like, this is the pop night, this is the, like, more slow country / folklore songs night. I would go to anything. I would just love to hear her live again. It's been so long.
I'd like to see you try and get a ticket. I would for like, even one of them.
I would like to see you the time I don't get a ticket.
I would not like to see that.
No, I just really, really need to see her live again, and we're manifesting something amazing coming soon. But Pete, will you be wearing any of the Midnight's merch to the tour?
I'll be holding my incense cubes and my brown square photo frame Ramanek.
That'll be a Can't Buy Fit.
The merch is never ending. They just released even more tie-dye garments, is the only thing I can say.
True.
There's one with all the track names on it, and I don't like that one.
It's horrible. And doesn't even
and
have
socks
any ones
that just say Taylor Midnight's in like Comic Sans.
She needs to start employing better people to do the merch. Like, the merch is really not good. She needs people from Etsy who are doing amazing designs, independent artists who are making better merch than the stuff she's charging so much for. I mean, £45 for a vinyl case.
You can buy it in B&M Bargains for £3. We would definitely be remiss if we're talking about Midnight's to not talk about the 6.3 million different vinyls that you can buy and arrange into the shape of the Hunger Games arena for the Quarter Quell.
The Quarter Quell will be trying to get tickets for the next one. I know there's a lot of different vinyls. Who would buy multiple? Me, but otherwise, I don't know. It's a lot of money to spend. There's a cost of living crisis. Taylor's got more money than the UK government right now.
She really gagged everyone who forked out 4 times the amount of money to make the clock. And then now there's 7 more songs that you need from each vinyl that you just bought that only has 13 now. Plus there's a Target version which has 1 bonus track and 2 piano versions or guitar versions. Or
the only thing about it that I really can't stand by is the fact that they said that all of these other vinyls were only available for 72 hours. You had to buy it. You had to buy it. They're still available now, 4 or 5 weeks later. I think that's so duplicitous and like kind of illegal to do something like that. I think it's very, very in bad faith to say you can only get these for these 3 days, but also for the next 4 weeks you can also buy it. So yeah, just to wrap up all of our final thoughts, it is just far too soon to try and put a determination of where this fits in her discography. But even in the times that I've listened to it today, every single time, I've got more out of it. I've really enjoyed it more. I already liked it, but I've really built up such a strong connection to some of these songs. And over the next few months, I know it's just going to grow me even more. Pete, if you had to pick your top 3 songs on the spot, what would you go for?
I feel bad because I have had less time with the 3 a.m. versions. Yeah. But I think off the top of my head, I would say Karma.
But.
Lavender Haze. Amaroon, probably. But I don't know. There's so many different flavors in this album. And contrary to how I feel about Lover, where I feel like it's very sporadic and up and down, up and down, up and down. The concept of this album is that it can be any kind of thought or mindset you find yourself in at a certain time of the night. So if it is erratic to me, I relate to that because we've all been in that position where we're happy, we're sad, we're remembering the past, we're laughing with the past, we're crying about the past.
I'm alive. I'm dead. I'm watching TV. I'm looking at you. Fuck you. I'm dead again.
And I just think that's so human. So I'm excited to see where my tastes will linger and where I'll completely 180. But what about you, Paul? What are yours?
It's difficult, but I will say Lavender Haze, Karma, I'm copying you on those two. The third one, I probably would say would have, could have, should have. There's a lot of raw honesty. There's a lot of love. I think they go across multiple different eras of her life. And I just really think her vocals shine the most on these songs. But yeah, it's difficult. They're all really strong.
We asked our listeners over on Instagram at SnapPod to let us know what their favorites were. We got a lot of love for You're On Your Own Kid. Joel messaged to say, I don't think I'm on my own when I say You're On Your Own Kid.
Which, Clever King.
Wordplay. Ruby agreed, also saying potentially one of her best bridges ever. Now, she is a person who can build a bridge. Sure. And I'm crossing the bridge. Queen Jo writing in saying jail time. You know what? True.
Lock her up.
You're On Your Own Kid does deserve jail time. Also love from it from Aaron and my good friend Abby writing in to say You're On Your Own Kid, a mastermind, and the childhood demons they both conjured and soothed, which I love.
We also got some love for Antihero from Curtis and Carly.
And some people with taste who also picked Lavender. He is Dylan, Aaron, Owen and Carly again. Come on, Carly.
Carly was greedy. She was like, I love all the album and I agree. We also got some love for Would've, Could've, Should've, which I think is amazing, from Joel. Thank you so much, Joel. He also said that Would've, Could've, Should've Said No will be a good mashup at the Midnight's version, Taylor's version tour, whatever it's going to be called. I want that.
We'll be crying and bopping and shaking our tits. And finally, we got to give love to friend of the pod, Philip, who shouted out Maroon, Midnight Rain and Bigger Than the Whole Sky. So we've pretty much got the album covered with different people liking different songs.
I think it really goes to show how diverse this album is and how different people relate to different midnight thoughts and things that keep them up at night. And I love to see that range. Thank you so much to everybody for writing in.
Thank you so, so much to all of our listeners for tuning in to this special, kind of long bonus episode of Snapped. It was a stream of consciousness and we were just so excited to get our thoughts out there and interact with everyone else. As always, you can follow us along on our socials at SnapPod over on Instagram, where we post behind the scenes content and visuals of everything we talk about in the episode. And don't forget to subscribe to Snapped on Apple Music and Spotify. We're really close to getting 50 reviews on Spotify, so if you can get your friends to stan us, it's really helpful. And click that notification bell so you know when season 2 is going to drop.
Yes, thank you everybody. As usual, we've been your hosts. I'm Paul.
And I've been Pete.
And we will definitely see you soon.